Dr. Berlin commented on the rapidly emerging area of research on inhibition of EGFR, and I met with Dr. Heinz-Josef Lenz to learn more about how inhibition of this pathway can affect tumor cell growth. Dr. Lenz began by providing an overview of this area.
The EGF receptor turns out to be a very critical mainstay of tumor development, tumor progression, metastases, and invasion. So without EGF receptor, the colon cancer would be a completely different animal. So that is one of the reasons when we inhibit this receptor, we see consistent efficacy. Because when you look at the data, either of one of these two agents, you have really efficacy in third, fourth line chemotherapy, independent on the number of pretreatment, which actually signals and gives us some clues that this receptor is untouched by the classical chemotherapy. There are no mechanism of cross resistance, as well as how important this receptor is in the process of tumor progression. Now, one of the most exciting things is that these agents seem to have significant synergism with classical chemotherapy, because by themselves, they are able to shrink tumors, as we know, about 10% in third line and fourth line chemotherapy. But I think one of the amazing data over the last couple of years is the combination of cetuximab and irinotecan in the BOND trial, as well as the combination with these with bethazuzumab and irinotecan in the BOND 2 trial. So here we have evidence that there is synergism between irinotecan, there are data synergism with oxaliplatin, there are data synergism with Avastin or bethazuzumab, indicating that this pathway have significant crosstalks and probably explain that when you hit EGF receptor and chemo and VHF pathways, you will have much more effect. So that's what we try to find out, why that is. And with the data, we may be understanding who benefits most. So the first goal was to look, what is the mechanism of resistance of cetuximab? We actually went back to the literature and just looked, do we have animal models suggesting where cetuximab would really not work? And there are data in the literature from animal models from Italy, from Padalucci, showing when tumors overexpress VEGF, cetuximab will not work. So we did in our own clinical trial at USC a study with 40 patients treated with cetuximab, again, third and fourth line, and measured VEGF in the tumor. And that's exactly what we found. That is published in JCO last year, that tumors with high levels of VEGF do not respond to cetuximab.
Is this VEGF on the tumor cell itself?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the VEGF is expressed because the VEGF is produced by tumor cells, and then the receptors may be on the endothelial cells as well as maybe on the tumor cells, which we have shown and Lee Ellis's group has shown that the VEGF receptor is not only expressed on the endothelial cells, but also significantly on tumor cells, which is actually very interesting because when you do anti-VEGF treatment, you don't have only anti-angiogenic effect, but also anti-tumor effect.
And what happens with treatment if you add in bevacizumab?
Well, you bind the VEGF away, and I think that is one of the reasons when you combine cetuximab and bethazuzumab, you have a synergistic effect.
What about in the laboratory?
In the laboratory, you have significant synergism. Yes, yes. So that is actually coming from the in vivo animal studies that we knew that VEGF was one of the mainstay, which is kind of surprising because you don't think of cetuximab primarily as an anti-angiogenic effect, but it is. There is a mainstay.
Can you contrast sort of the chemistry of panitumumab and cetuximab and the mechanisms of action?
So both have the same mechanism of action in way of inhibiting the receptor on the tumor cells. And the downstream effects are very clearly defined by inhibiting two major pathways, AKT and MAP kinase. And it's very important to understand that, you know, works by Zelga and Arteaga showed very nicely. When you inhibit the EGF receptor by these antibodies, you have phosphorylation of these two pathways. But when you look at the pathways, the jelly bean picture, you know, when you have any alterations in that particular pathway, you will not be effective in order to inhibit EGF receptor downstream events. So KRAS mutations, AKT mutations, PI3 kinase mutations, which are downstream of EGF receptor, if you have alterations and activating mutations, the inhibition of an upstream event would be neglected. So these are now being investigated, and some data really prove that alteration this pathway will be associated with resistance. So what is the difference between panitumumab and cetuximab? Because I think that's where you're aiming at. Well, I think you have to go back to the structure of the antibody. The efficacy of the antibody are determined by two major functions. One is the affinity of the antibody to the receptor, which is the Fab component of the antibody. And the other one is the possibility of an ADCC, which is an antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity, which means the antibody can stimulate an immune response of the body. Now, cetuximab is an IgG1 antibody, and panitumumab is an IgG2 antibody. We know very well established for Herceptin and rituximab, which are also both IgG1 antibodies, they can induce ADCC, and this is part of the cell toxicity. So our group actually looked in our patient population, is there any evidence of ADCC for patients treated with cetuximab? The direct measurement of ADCC is extremely complicated and basically not possible. You can only indirectly indicate there is a potential immune response by the activity level of the Fc gamma receptors 2 and 3, which are expressed on natural killer cells, recognizing the Fc component of the IgG1 antibody, and then initiate a cell lysis. This is not reported for IgG2, or there are significant controversy. So we looked in 40 patients and identified that patients who have a certain activity level of receptor 2 and A of the Fc gamma family had association with response and time to tumor progression to cetuximab. Now, this polymorphism have been shown to be associated with outcome for the other antibodies such as Herceptin and rituximab. So we think this is an indication there is a potential ADCC effect. We are now validating, because we had only 40 patients, these in 100 patients enrolled in the cetuximab study of 144, and see if we can validate this, because these are very preliminary and early pilot data. Now, interesting to know is that there is significant efforts from different companies in order to recognize the potential value of ADCC and focusing on optimizing antibodies. They go on antibodies, optimize the FAP component to do higher affinity, as well as the Fc component to induce more ADCC. So there is a significant belief that this could increase efficacy of the overall antibody. We just clinically have not a lot of evidence except our pilot data that this is true for cetuximab, which would be a difference to panitumumab. To see that in a metastatic disease patient who failed 3-line chemotherapy is, of course, very difficult, because we all know the immune response capacity with metastatic disease goes down. I think this could be of significant value in the adjuvant setting, where you have a much more healthier immune system, and maybe here the immune response would be clinically more meaningful.
The other two factors that have been discussed from a practical clinical perspective, and I know you see patients as well as doing all this incredible laboratory work, is the Q2-week interval and the lack of infusion reactions. How does that stack up to you clinically?
Yeah, we have been very lucky with infusion reactions that took some up. So I know practices who have experienced that early on, it's a really scary event, and you get very, very afraid of that would happen again. We have treated thousands of patients that had really only one reaction, which was early captured and was not a problem. We have actually a kind of mechanism, since we had early involved in early clinical trials, we put in when patients get first treated with cetuximab, we have a mark, a standing pre-order, that if patients get a first time, we have all medications listed in case of any event, we interfere, we don't have first to call a doctor, avoiding any significant delays. There is certainly an infusion reaction with cetuximab because this antibody is chimeric and has a little bit mouse protein. The reaction is about 3-4%. Now, today, most of the time, cetuximab is used in combination with chemo, at least in our institution, particularly with irinotecan, which usually has a pre-medication with Decatron. So the infusion reaction has significantly come down because it's now maybe 1 or 1.5%. Because most of the reactions which are maybe grade 1 or grade 2 are gone with the Decatron pre-medication.
How do you explain the fact that there are other parts of the country where Jordan Berlin or Rich Goldberg talk about 10 or 15% of their patients having reactions and this question of geography? Do you think that exists?
I have also heard about this. I'm not sure. I think there are certainly different genetic backgrounds explaining differences, which has been very established for different ethnic population. To have pockets of the same ethnic background reacting differently would be a very unique pattern. Now, the reaction to the antibodies are two different things. One is the reaction to the mouse protein, and the other one is the reaction to the epitope. So it would be very interesting to see if this is a reaction to the mouse, which we would accept as like a potential infusion reaction, or are there allergic reactions just to the epitope of the antibody, which can happen probably much more dependent on your sensitivity, on your frequency of allergic reaction. We all know somebody that has a certain history of allergic reaction, you're more likely to react to something else.
I guess what I've heard is the speculation that this is some kind of environmental exposure or sensitization or cross-sensitization. Does that make any sense?
I have a hard time to follow that. I'm not sure about this. I don't think it's a classical allergic reaction to the protein. Maybe some epitope. Now, why that is, I do not know. And there are a lot of speculations. I'm not sure if this is an environmental factor.
Where are we right now in terms of predictors of response or non-response with EGFR antibodies?
Yeah, I think at the moment, the only established factors published and kind of peer-reviewed is the intratumoral expression level of VHF from our group, as well as Laurent Pouet's group in France for RAS mutations. There are some data coming out at probably this year's ASCO GI and ASCO looking at additional factors, mutations in the pathway as well as potential value of the ligands. I think with this data, I would like to see to do a prospective trial to sort out patients who have a mutant KRAS or have a wild type or have high levels of VHF to see if we can increase the efficacy by pre-selecting patient population.
Do you think that those predictors are close to being available for clinical use?
I think for the clinical everyday use in the community practices, we need the prospective trial to validate them. Now, that can be done quickly. I think one of the reasons we are meeting every year and we have no markers still in the community practice is that we have experienced such a change of standardization of chemotherapy. Every time we meet, there is a new drug, there is a new combination. So the time necessary to validate markers is catched by the way of changing of standard of care, which makes it very difficult to implement. I think at the moment we are reaching at least, I think for a little while, a plateau where we recognize FOLFOX and FOLFOI and cetuximab, bevacizumab as a standard of care. And we are now able to validate this markers in prospective or at least in large retrospective trials. So I think that would be the basis to continue and hopefully then put markers in the community practice.
You mentioned your work looking at VEGF. Can you talk about that also?
Yeah, so we were also very interested in the angiogenic pathways. The first, we all know about the challenges PTK had in CONFIRM 1 and 2 being negative in combination with FOLFOX in first and second line. But the subgroup analysis showed that patients with high serum LDH did have a benefit of PTK. So we were looking for potential explanation why patients with high serum LDH would benefit from an inhibitor of VEGF receptors. So what we did is we looked in our own patient population. We took about 40 patients, pulled all tumor specimens of the primary tumor, the metastasis, the lymph nodes, and just measured the levels of genes which are involved, because we know high serum LDH are usually associated with tumor burden. Usually bigger tumors are more hypoxic. If you're hypoxic, you have induction of HIF-1 alpha and initiation of pathways such as glycolysis, angiogenesis, erythropoiesis, and so on. And we wanted to see, is that really true in vivo? And what we found, that the patients with high serum LDH had a significant upregulation of HIF-1 alpha, VHEF, and VHEF receptor 1. In fact, when we measured the LDH5 in the tumor, it was associated with glycolysis, angiogenesis, with VHF, VHF receptors, with all the factors which would make a lot of sense when you look at the pathway. Now, that's important information because it really proves the principle that patients with high serum LDH have probably a significant stimulation of the hypoxic pathway, upregulating potentially VHF and VHF receptors, and therefore have a potential more target for VHF receptor inhibitors.
Has anyone looked at serum LDH and benefits from bevacizumab in colon cancer?
Yeah, I'm sure people have looked. I have not seen any data, which is a very logical question, because if it would be the case, I think the discussion about PTK would stop right now. Okay, so I think...
Stop right now and people would say, yeah, it probably does work. You just need to use it in the right patients.
Well, I think if this would work, if there is no reason to believe there is a niche for the VHF receptor inhibitors and high serum LDH, and Avastin has a similar benefit, I'm not sure what the value is to go in with VHF receptor inhibitors in colon cancer. Now, as you know, there is a completely different story in kidney cancer. It's just reversed. Avastin has effect, but, you know, the sorafenibs and the sutinibs are much more successful. In fact, we went back and looked at 50 kidneys and 50 colons just to know, is there a difference? Why do these drugs work so great in kidney cancers and so poorly in colon cancers? And when we look at VHF or VHF receptor 1 and 2 and 3, they're about 50 to 100-fold different. The genetic upregulation of VHF receptors in kidney cancers allows the TKI of the VHF receptor to be more successful than the ligand inhibition. In colon cancer, is there a similar situation if you have hypoxic tumors? We do not know, but there may be some rationale behind it. We at the moment do analysis of these in samples from Confirm 1 and 2 to see if this is correct.
Are you interested in looking at tumors from people who have been treated with bevacizumab for the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, we are very interested in the, of course, mechanism of action of bevacizumab, because this is at the moment the only effective agents for angiogenesis in colon cancer. I think we still have to learn much more about how bevacizumab works, the different sequential mechanism of actions by increasing temporal blood flow to the tumor, eventually decreasing this blood flow is up in the air. The time factor is not known. How long does the temporary normalization last? There are different speculations. How does it interfere with the effect of chemotherapy? Are there conditions which would confer resistance to bevacizumab? And when tumors grow again, how do they overcome the sensitivity?
So right now, in general, how do you approach first-line therapy metastatic colon cancer?
I usually use either a backbone of FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, and usually use bevacizumab as my first line.
Which is what most people are doing.
Yes. We know some patients will benefit more from FOLFIRI and some patients will benefit more from FOLFOX, and that will be true for cetuximab and it will be true for bevacizumab. We actually looked into mechanism of resistance to bevacizumab, because there must be, because we know this agent has by itself very little activity. It needs chemotherapy to really be cytotoxic effective. So we looked, are there actually evidences for mechanism of resistance? Because we all think this is just a slam dunk. And again, we went back to the animal models. What do we know from animal models? And you can learn quite a lot. So when you look in different models where you, for example, knock out VEGF, you would think a tumor would be not able to maintain angiogenesis. And that is not true. There are pathways which are independent of VEGF which can sustain angiogenesis. These pathways include interleukin-8. These pathways include adrenomedulin. Now, there are actually very interesting data in vitro and vivo. Then you use antibody, for example, with interleukin-8, you have an anti-angiogenic effect. And when you combine it with bevacizumab, you have significant synergism. So we looked into a clinical trial, not in colon, because you cannot do Avastin as a single agent. We looked in ovarian cancer, treated with bevacizumab and low-dose cyclophosphamide, the metronomic way, and looked for, can we identify patients who respond more likely from bevacizumab and cyclophosphamide? and one of the strongest marker, and we could predict response, was interleukin-8 and interleukin-8 chemoreceptor 2. Now, do I say this marker can be used now in the clinical practice and we check it and we give it? No. But it's for the first time an establishment of a mechanism of angiogenesis independent of VEGF, making some efforts possible to maybe look more carefully into the mechanism of resistance, potentially combine it with interleukin-8 antibodies in this patient population, and then look what tumors do have high levels of interleukin-8 as a potential mechanism. Now, the most recent study using bevacizumab in pancreas cancer in combination with gemcitabine was negative. Now, when you look at interleukin-8 and pancreas cancer, you know there is a significant upregulation of interleukin-8 in this disease. Now, I'm not saying this is the reason, but it's certainly an interesting hypothesis to think that maybe interleukin-8 plays a role in the efficacy of bevacizumab treatment.
Are you doing any work or do you have any thoughts about some of the mechanisms of side effects and toxicities that have been seen with bevacizumab, particularly the hypertension?
Hypertension is very difficult because in order to get markers for that, you know, are the patients treated or not treated and how good they are treated? If they are effectively treated with antihypertensive, you would see it much less effective. So we have not done any hypertension or any CNS side effects. What we have done is for cetuximab for skin toxicity, because we were interested in that, can we predict skin toxicity? Because that is one of the best surrogate markers for outcome. You know, we don't need molecular markers for cetuximab. We wait 3-4 weeks and we know what the likelihood of it is. And we know now the principle of concept was presented at Istanbul 2 at ESMO in the Everest trial when patients had no skin toxicity with cetuximab and increased the doses and they reached skin toxicity, they were more likely to respond. So you can reverse that, which is a very interesting proof of principle trial. So we looked at that because we were very interested, can we predict? Now, there are two things we've kind of got across. One is that when we looked at COX-2 expression, which was associated with skin toxicity. Now, the level of COX-2 may play a role in the EGF receptor pathway, but it plays also a role in the angiogenic pathway. There are interesting data from Raymond Dubois in Vanderbilt, where he combines a COX-2 inhibitor with an EGF receptor TKI and has significant synergism
in
animal models, in colon cancers. So there may be something. I think COX-2 may be an important gene in this pathway, which has been overlooked and dramatized by the side effects in the chemoprevention trials. The other fact which came to our attention is that when you look at the skin toxicity of cetuximab, you see typically the acne, the folliculitis. But on long run, you see this erythema. You see really this skin inflammation pattern. Now, when you're a big fan of ADCC, you could postulate that some of the effect and skin rashes and erythema and inflammation is induced by ADCC because this interaction includes a lot of cytokine release leading to erythema. I tried to correlate that, but the problem is in these clinical trials, the quality and the extent of the erythema is not very well captured, as you can imagine. So I think that is one of the reasons, and I'm not saying this is 100% correlated, but I think that would be an interesting thing to look, because I think the acne is not the major issue. I think it's the long-term skin erythema and the patches which seem not to go away in some of the patients.
That's fascinating. Just out of curiosity, how do you manage the rash?
Usually when it's just onset, we actually give, when there are any pustulous, we put topical antibiotics on it. If it's really significant, where you have significant skin involvement in the face and chest, we also do oral antibiotics, clindamycin or tetracyclines. When it's really dry skin, of course, moisturizer. If there's a lot of erythema and not pustulous, we also use steroid creams, which seem to help very nicely. For fissures, we just use superglue. For the paronychia, which seems to be a long-term, really annoying side effect for patients who use a lot of their fingers, We usually use a lot of Vaseline as a barrier around the fingernail beds, which prevents the infection, because first you have just the skin fissures and the paronychia, and then the super infection with the bacteria. These needs to be treated with antibiotics, you know, so protective shoe wear and so on is part of the comprehensive way of handling the skin toxicities.
Now, the NSABP has closed accrual on their adjuvant bevacizumab C08 trial after 2 years, and now they're ready for the next step before they even get the results from that one. And what they're talking about now is FOLFOX-BEV plus or minus either cetuximab or panitumumab. What do you think about that idea, and which one of the agents do you think makes more sense?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I'm not sure if I have the right answer personally, but I think certainly we need the backbone of FOLFOX. As you know, there has been a lot of discussion, is 6 months of FOLFOX really necessary? There were a lot of attempts within the intergroup to go down to 3 months, which did not happen for a lot of different reasons, including political reasons. So we have the 6 months of FOLFOX, and with the clinical trials ongoing, there was an agenda to push bevacizumab for an additional 6 months. And as you know, we have no control if this 6 months will help, because the only control is FOLFOX without bevacizumab. I think that we need to know in the adjuvant setting, is an EGF receptor and anti-angiogenic more effective? We need to compare them side by side. The problem is we don't probably have the chance if we do not know the outcome of CO8, because if CO8 is positive for the bevacizumab, that will become standard of care. The question is then to have to add on the cetuximab treatment. There are two particular issues I think needs to be considered. About the safety. Patients in the adjuvant setting are basically cured or high chance of cured. Any side effects which would be considered significant, like perforation, heart attacks, are not acceptable. That is what killed Celeprex and Vioxx in very small numbers. So we need to see what the data are in the CO8. The cetuximab from that aspect is much safer. It's more a cosmetic problem. Are the patients able to do that for 6 months and willing to do that with the skin toxicity? But at least there would be no threat of life-threatening toxicity. So there are a lot of things to weigh against each other. If bevacizumab has a traumatic effect, of course you would go ahead with this medication, limited by the low risk of side effects. But in the adjuvant setting, low risk has a different meaning than low risk in metastatic disease. From my understanding, the mechanism of action of bevacizumab in the advanced disease sites at the moment are probably considered the temporary normalization of vascularization as well as the anti-angiogenic effect. Now, the first is not present in the adjuvant setting. So how will bevacizumab work only as an anti-angiogenic effect, because you do not have this normalization of blood flow in the tumor? There is no disease. So how will that look into that efficacy profile in the adjuvant setting? For the EGF receptor pathways, there are some data that EGF receptor is associated with tumor recurrence. So you have some mechanism rationale saying if EGF receptor is expressed, you had higher risk for tumor recurrence. Inhibiting this pathway may decrease it.
Although, is there a correlation between EGFR and response to cetuximab?
No, there is not. Because what has been looked at so far is the immunohistochemistry, which we, I think, all agree is not a sufficient method to select patients, not only for treatment, but certainly not for success. The only immunohistochemistry used in community practices, which is reliable, is ERPR.
And that's not too reliable.
Right, I know, that's my point. So HER2, forget it. EGF receptor, forget it. So the argument of association, doesn't mean it's not.
You just have to measure it differently?
Yes.
How do you measure it?
To be more reliable, I would do RNA. I would do gene expression. There have been no studies done. There is a study published in lung cancer which showed that the EGF receptor gene expression related to the outcome to a TKI. So this is the first evidence that maybe the technology will be more helpful to predict patients' outcome.
And again, in breast cancer, you have the Oncotype DX assay, which people are starting to say, well, you know, maybe this is the way we ought to measure ER and HER2. Is that sort of along the same lines of what you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, I think that's because that's gene expression.
I want to ask you about something else that is kind of unrelated, but I'd be curious to know what you think about. which is the presentation that was done on ASCO looking at the side effects of fluoropyrimidine monotherapy based on geography. Can you comment on what was looked at and what your thoughts are in view of all the work that you've done in that area?
Yeah, so Dan Haller presented this data, and the reason he looked comprehensively at different regions and the frequency of side effects to 5-FU or Xeloda is the ongoing discrepancy between the toxicities reported in Europe than the US. Now, we know there are significant differences in 5-FU toxicity among different ethnic populations. Asians, African Americans, and Caucasians are different. We know that, and that is explained by the genetic makeup of the patient. Not the tumor, but the patient. Now, you cannot apply that for differences between Europe and the US, because most of the patients looked in the US, of course, are Caucasians as well as the Europeans. So why would there be a big difference? And there was, in the beginning, a controversial, heated discussion, is because the Americans accused the Europeans that their research nurses don't capture the side effects so much.
The Europeans were saying that the Americans don't do good patient education.
Exactly. And they told or accused the Americans that the American patients are wussies, okay? They complain about everything. So I think the truth is probably a mixture of a lot of things, but looking at now with Dan's data, looking, are there differences? What are potentially explaining that? Because we both know physicians and nurses and patients and doctors around the world are now very well educated about this pathway. There are differences. One is the biggest difference between Europe and US is the supplementation with folates in food, which, as we know, has a big benefit for cardiovascular and neurological development and so on. In Europe, that is not the case. We also know that Americans are much more eager to supplement their diet with vitamins, high doses of different supplements, including folic acid. And particular, the benefits of folic acid down-regulating homocysteine had also an effect that a lot of people pop these pills. Now, we think that one of the major explanations for the differences may be the supplement of folate in our food and the supplements. So in Europe, that is not the case. People also use vitamin supplementation, but not in the same extent. In fact, as you imagine, they are much more organic and they're not doing that so much. Now, saying that, there are also significant developments in the folate pathway. This data will be published very soon and looked at probably and put folate in a different view. We know when patients have no polyps, are healthy and take folate, we can prevent colon cancer. But if patients have polyps, the growth of the polyps may be faster with folic acid.
That's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that happen?
Because folic acid is a major supplement for DNA synthesis. If you have an ongoing growth, it may fuel the growth. Now, it doesn't mean that they will get faster into cancer, but there is certainly some evidence. Then there are data which also will be published showing that maybe the folate supplementation in patients with cancer may be not a good idea, because with the same principle. So at the moment in my practice, I do not recommend any folic acid supplementation in patients who have a history of polyps or have active disease. I'm working with multiple researchers to look into the value of folic acid supplementation. I'm involved in a colon cancer family registry collecting 10,000 people around the US, Canada, and Australia, where we look and collected information on folate intake, development of cancer, and how this would influence. So you can make an interesting argument, and here the environment may take a place and lifestyle. If you're taking folic acid, if you're taking Celebrex, if you're taking aspirin, and you develop colon cancer, believe me, the behavior and the makeup of these tumors is different in comparison when you wouldn't have taken it.
In what specifically way?
Well, if COX-2 is one of the ways of early development and you inhibit it, the tumors will find another ways to grow. Now, that may be more or less aggressive. What I'm saying, you change the behavior of a tumor by trying to prevent it with certain pathways.
So getting back to the fluoropyrimidine toxicity, what's the mechanism there?
So because folates are increasing 5-FU toxicity, okay? So the more folate you take, the higher the toxicity is. So the thing is, we think one of the reasons is there may be some difference of genetic background because our populations kind of grow and have changed with others, and the genetic background is not anymore as homogeneous as when the immigrants came over from Europe. However, I don't think that's the only explanation. I think there is a lifestyle factor in that equation explaining the difference in the region. From my point of view, it's a combination of a genetic background as well as folic supplementation as the most reasonable explanation for the differences in the regional difference. And that's actually what Dan Haller concluded. Okay. And I think we still have to learn a lot. You know, I mean, the interesting story, for example, is the drug S1, which is in clinical trials, is another TS inhibitors. So has tremendous activity in gastric cancer, pancreas cancer, and colon cancer in Japan. When the study was done in gastric cancer in the US, the MTD is much lower than in Japan. They just do not tolerate the same level.
And this is, what is the mechanism of action?
A TS inhibitor, like 5-FU.
What's the difference?
The difference is S1 is independent of DBD, so it's not detoxified by DBD. So therefore, it should have higher efficacy because high DBD can overcome 5-FU efficacy. So S1 has shown in the studies we have so far higher efficacy profiles than 5-FU. Of course, this is now being evaluated in colon cancer in combination with oxaliplatin and irinotecan. And it's a pill. It's like Xeloda.
What would you guess would be the efficacy compared to capecitabine?
It will be higher than capecitabine because capecitabine is also dependent of the DBD detoxification. Depending what numbers you look up, about 20 to 30% of resistance to 5-FU or capecitabine is dependent of DBD. So you would think that some of these patients may be still sensitive to S1. And the efficacy data seem to be saying that this is possible. Never a side-by-side comparison has been done.
The last thing I want to ask you, just to continue in the weird world of the molecular biology, is I'm just curious what your thoughts are. It may seem unrelated, but about the findings from the CALGB adjuvant IFL trial looking at exercise, showing what seems to be a decrease in relapse rate. I know they're going to be looking at diet, and that should be very interesting in the same study. Where do you see exercise and diet fitting into these molecular pathways?
Ah, that's a good question. I don't have a good answer for that, but I think at the end of the day, the risk for tumor recurrence depends on your genetic makeup and on your lifestyle, okay? I think we know very well the risk factors for colon cancer, which is red meat, alcohol, and exercise, okay? Now, why would that be, and how is that interfering with the potential recurrence, and what molecular pathways are involved? Well, we all know when we exercise, we stimulate our immune system, we stimulate our blood flow, we stimulate potential steroid pathways and morphins and so on. Some of these will have an effect to better control the microenvironment in our tissues, okay? We know that our bowel works much better, the activity is better, more bowel activity is better to prevent. But see, the activity is not the only thing. I'm convinced that when you have residual disease, which, you know, after adjuvant treatment is what we treat, is that the environment determines how successful the tumor is to survive, okay? Because you have two compartments. One is the environment this cell's hiding in, and then is the activity of this single or single cells hiding in it. The microenvironment is very powerful, okay? If this microenvironment is optimized by any system, which I think can be like exercise.
Optimized though, but molecularly, what's going on?
What's going on? Well, for example, when you do upregulation of certain pathways, the integrins go up, the cytokines go up, which will be able to control a tumor cells much better.
What about insulin growth factor?
Mm-hmm. So that is another factor which goes into stress-related events like exercise. The problem at the moment with IGF and IGF receptor 1, we don't know what the prognostic and clinical relevance is. We know it's related to cancer development, much better established for liver cancer than for colon cancer, but it's certainly a significant growth factor. Is that related to exercise? I'm not aware of it. But
how about diet?
To IGF, it is.
But not necessarily exercise.
Yes, but they're all interlinking factors. As you know, if you exercise, you have less need for insulin, you have less insulin resistance, you have less cardiovascular issues, as well you have a better environmental structure.
So I'm guessing that you advise your patients who've gotten adjuvant therapy for colon cancer to try to exercise and decrease their fat intake. Is that the case?
Absolutely.
And when you do that, do you say maybe this is going to decrease your chance of relapse?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, or do you say you think it will?
I think it will. I'm convinced of that. I think the major factors we know is certainly alcohol, certainly red meat, certainly exercise.
In terms of relapse, though, alcohol and red meat?
Development, not relapse.
What about relapse? I mean, there was a 50% reduction in relapse, retrospectively granted, in that CALGB trial. Maybe there's some other explanation.
Yeah. Do you mean for exercise?
Yeah,
for exercise. I know. I'm completely convinced that this is a true factor.
Hmm.
I don't think we know all the molecular mechanism. I mean, I speculated with the tissue microenvironment, which I think is probably important. But for the recurrence, for diet, there are very little data for recurrence, only for the development, to my knowledge.
Well, in breast cancer, you have diet. You have
yes,
the
WIND
study.
Yes.
Right.
For colon, I'm not sure are there data. I don't know if the CLGB has diet data.
They're looking at it.
Right.
And I've heard rumors. Let's
right.
say. We'll see what
right.
happens. They haven't presented it yet, but they're looking at it.
Right. And that makes sense.
Yeah, they're looking at it.
But, you know, diet is related to exercise. You know, when you do exercise, you eat differently.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
So it's
absolutely. Right. Right.
So it's a very interesting new thing in order to, and see, I'm convinced that these factors will change the molecular level of you, the patient, as well as potentially the interaction with the tumor. It's not the exercise does it. There is something in between who makes that happen. And that's on a molecular level, no doubt.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Colorectal Cancer Update.